Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're zeroing in on errors in emissions insurance. You know.
Yeah, right.
If you're in sales or, well, provide professional services, think of this as your professional shield. It protects you when the unexpected happens in your day-to-day business.
And what's really interesting, I think, is the environment we're all working in now, business dealings that are just getting more and more intricate.
Yeah. Definitely seems that way.
And unfortunately, so is the chance of, you know, legal challenges. People seem more willing now to sue if they feel like professional advice or services cause them some kind of harm.
Mm-hmm.
That whole heightened risk landscape, that's really a big driver for why E&O insurance is just so critical these days.
Absolutely. So our goal today is to really unpack E&O insurance. We want to clarify why it's often, well, a necessity, not just a nice to have, for a whole range of professionals.
Right.
And fundamentally, how it actually works to protect you from, you know, potential financial disaster and other big problems. We've really dug into a specific document focusing on E&O insurance to pull out the key stuff for you.
Yeah, and we've got quite a bit planned. We'll start with the basic, the core definition and purpose of E&O. Then we'll look at the kinds of losses it typically covers. And just as important, what it usually doesn't cover.
Okay.
We'll also dig into, you know, proactive steps you can take to cut down the chances of claims happening in the first place. And finally, we'll touch on some key features of claims-made policies. Okay, so let's get into it.
All right, so let's cut to the chase. What is E&O insurance in, like, practical terms?
Okay, simply put, E&O insurance is there to protect you, your business, from financial losses. Losses that come from claims saying you were negligent, made an error, or overlooked something in the professional services you provide.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it like this. If a client says your mistake cost them money, this is the kind of insurance that can, you know, step in and help manage that whole situation.
Okay. Can you give us some maybe real-world examples? How might this actually play out?
Sure, sure. Imagine, say, a marketing consultant. Their advice, maybe accidentally, leads to a client's campaign failing and boom, significant financial loss.
Ouch.
Or maybe a software developer, right? A coding error crashes the client's entire system. Big problem. It could also cover claims where maybe expectations weren't met, a service wasn't delivered as promised,
mm-hmm.
or even cases of, like, negligent overselling, where a client feels they were pushed into buying something that just wasn't right for them. And importantly, this coverage usually extends to the legal bills, the costs of defending lawsuits related to your professional services, even if the claim turns out to be bogus.
Right, so it's not just about, like, tangible mistakes, but also the advice given. And it's not a standard thing, is it? It's different for different jobs.
Exactly. E&O insurance is specifically designed, tailored really, to the risks that are inherent in different professions and the unique kind of advice they give. The coverage an IT consultant needs is going to be pretty different from, say, a landscape architect.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Speaking of different professions, who usually needs E&O? It's got to be more than just insurance agents, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the scope is surprisingly wide. You're looking at professionals like accountants, CPAs, auditors, people dealing with financial details where mistakes can be costly.
Okay.
Lawyers, obviously, navigating all the risks of legal advice. Healthcare providers, insurance administrators facing potential malpractice claims. Architects and engineers, their designs carry huge responsibility.
Wow, yeah.
Real estate agents, appraisers, advising on big property deals. Even corporate directors and officers, they can be held responsible for their decisions.
That's already a pretty long list.
And it keeps going. Dentists, teachers, mortgage bankers, financial planners. Even employers themselves can need this kind of protection.
Mm.
And yes, definitely insurance agents, given the advice they provide.
Right.
Our source document actually points out that E&O can be relevant in, well, pretty much any industry where giving professional advice or services is a key part of the business.
Okay, so we get what it is, who might need it, but what's the actual financial hit if you don't have it and something goes wrong? The document talks about the true cost of claims. Let's dive into that.
Yeah, this is where it gets really significant. The document breaks it down into a few key areas, starting with loss exposure.
Loss exposure.
Yeah, think of it as just the potential for financial harm. It's got like three main parts. First, what's actually at risk could be money, your reputation, data.
Okay.
Second, what's the event that could cause the loss? Negligence, an error, maybe a system failure.
Right.
And third, what's the potential scale of that loss? Is it a small settlement, a massive lawsuit, or could it even, you know, sink your business? understanding those three things, what's at risk, the peril, and how bad it could be, that's really the foundation for figuring out your E&O needs and just how devastating a claim could potentially be.
That's a useful way to think about the underlying risk. Now, what about the direct costs if a claim is made? The document mentions insured losses. What does that actually cover?
So insured losses, that mostly means the settlement amount paid to the client who was harmed. But, and this is important, a really vital part often included in E&O policies is personal injury coverage.
Personal injury, like libel and slander.
Exactly. It extends protection against claims of libel, slander, and also invasion of privacy.
Okay, libel and slander, we hear those terms. Can you quickly clarify the difference in this context?
Sure. Libel is basically a damaging statement about someone that's published somehow online, print, whatever. It might be malicious, meaning without a good reason, but surprisingly, it could even be technically true and still be considered libel.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Slander, on the other hand, that's about spoken statements that are false and hurt someone's reputation.
Gotcha. And invasion of privacy sounds, well, broader.
It is, yeah. At its core, it's about unwarranted intrusion into someone's personal life. Could be anything from, say, inappropriate workplace surveillance to misusing confidential information. Now, privacy rights, they differ a bit between public figures and private individuals.
How so?
Well, celebrities, people who've kind of chosen to be in the public eye, they generally have less protection here, especially if the information is considered newsworthy and wasn't published with, like, actual malice.
Okay, so if you're not a public figure, what specific privacy rights do you generally have?
For private individuals, there are usually four key protections. The right to be free from intrusion into your private affairs, protection against public disclosure of embarrassing private facts, the right not to be portrayed falsely, and the right to control the commercial use of your name or image.
Hmm.
It's also worth mentioning there is a constitutional right to privacy, though it's somewhat limited, mainly focused on government intrusion where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Hmm. But yeah, these kinds of claims can obviously lead to pretty big settlements.
These all sound like they could result in really significant payouts. The document notes the high cost of these settlements, especially for doctors and lawyers. Why them specifically?
Well, the document suggests it's partly due to their high level of specialized education and the fact that their services maybe aren't as price sensitive. Basically, their expertise costs more, which can translate into bigger settlement demands if they're found liable. When we talk about what E&O might cover financially, it usually falls into two buckets. Losses related to things like medical bills, lost wages, legal fees, pain and suffering, even funeral costs.
Right.
And losses related to property damage to cars, homes, personal stuff, and so on.
So the settlement itself is obviously a major blow, but the document also really emphasizes defense costs. Why are those considered so critical?
Oh, this is absolutely crucial. E&O policies typically cover the cost of defending against a professional liability lawsuit, and this can be a huge financial lifesaver. Legal defense costs can just skyrocket really fast. Tens of thousands of dollars isn't unusual, even for claims that end up being thrown out.
Wow.
Without E&O, you, the insured, would be on the hook personally for all those court fees, lawyer charges, everything. With E&O, those costs are generally covered, but you might have a deductible. They're rightly called hidden costs, these massive legal fees that just pile up.
It's pretty sobering to think you could face huge legal bills even if you do nothing wrong.
Hmm.
Now, beyond the insured losses and defense costs, what about the uninsured losses? Things E&O might not directly pay for, but can still be devastating.
Yeah, often the most damaging uninsured loss is the hit to your reputation. A claim, even if it gets dismissed, can create negative press, cause revenue to drop, trigger more litigation.
Right.
Clients might leave, key employees might start looking elsewhere. Your organization's reputation, you know, built on its identity, how people see it, its performance, it's incredibly fragile.
The document gives some pretty stark examples of that, doesn't it? Wendy's with that false claim, Boeing and executive issues, Parmalat and fraud, all took massive reputational hits.
Exactly. Goldman Sachs is even quoted saying a damaged reputation is one of the hardest things to rebuild. On the flip side, companies with strong reputations, think Johnson & Johnson, Virgin Group, Porsche, they tend to do better financially, find it easier to hire and keep good people, and they bounce back better from crises.
Mm-hmm.
Threats to reputation can come from anywhere: natural disasters, ethical screw-ups, even deliberate attacks from outside groups.
And the fallout can be huge: share prices dropping, losing market share, trouble recruiting talent, unhappy communities. That Jack Welch quote really hits home. Perception is reality.
It really is. And while your standard E&O policy might not directly cover reputation damage, there are specialized policies out there, like reputation injury and communications liability, or RICL. But beyond that, other uninsured losses include, well, the time and lost income you might spend helping defend yourself. Losing clients and losing the referrals they bring, that's another big hit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe surprisingly, even your relationships with your insurance carriers can suffer after an E&O claim. That could affect future policy options, who you deal with, your compensation, how claims are handled, access to training, policy costs, even the tech they offer.
Mm-hmm.
Agents with good carrier relationships often get preferred treatment. Things run smoother, so a strained relationship can have ripple effects.
That's a lot more to think about than just the claim settlement itself. Now, the document also brings up deductibles. How do those usually work with E&O?
Pretty much like other insurance, yeah. E&O policies often have deductibles. That's the amount you pay out of pocket before the insurance kicks in.
Right.
These deductibles can apply per incident, both for the settlement amount, the liability part, and also for the defense costs. The example from Utica National shows that while policy limits can vary a lot, there's usually some deductible involved.
And these deductibles can sometimes cause problems, right? There was that example about a builder's risk policy.
Yes, exactly. That example showed how a misunderstanding, or maybe a misrepresentation, about the deductible in that case for hurricane damage led to disputes and unexpected costs for the policyholder.
Nah.
It just really underscores how important it is to have a clear, documented understanding of all parts of your policy, including the deductible.
Good point. Lastly, on costs, the document notes that renewal premiums can go up as a claims-made policy gets older. Why is that?
Okay, so with claims-made policies, the insurer is covering claims reported during the active policy period, right? Even if the mistake happened way back after the prior act date, which we'll get to.
Okay.
In the first few years of that policy, the insurer's potential risk pool is still fairly limited. But as time goes on, more past incidents could potentially turn into claims. So the insurer's overall exposure grows, which can lead to higher premiums at renewal time, even if you haven't had any claims.
Okay, that makes sense. That's a really thorough look at the true costs. Now let's switch gears. Let's talk about what E&O policies typically don't cover. What are some common exclusions we should know about?
Understanding these exclusions is absolutely vital.
Yeah.
The document lists several common ones. Punitive damages, those are meant to punish the insured for really bad conduct. They're generally excluded.
Right.
Also, violations related to ERISA and COBRA, those federal laws about employee retirement and health benefits, usually not covered by E&O.
That makes sense. Those areas have their own complex rules.
Yeah.
What else is typically out?
E&O insurance tends to be pretty selective, and it often excludes coverage for securities litigation. That's a really specialized field, complex laws, potential for massive claims.
Got it.
Also, professional services directly related to insurance operations are frequently excluded.
Like what specifically?
Things like acting as an insurer yourself, or a consultant, broker, agent in specific insurance deals, arranging coverages, handling claims under other policies, doing insurance audits, managing insurance investments, acting as a fiduciary for benefit plans, or offering fee-based services like inspections or appraisals related to insurance.
So if your E&O risk is tied directly to the insurance business itself, you probably need something separate.
Exactly, yeah. Other common exclusions include property management if you have an ownership stake in the property, violations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, and acts of terrorism.
Terrorism?
Yeah.
How's that defined?
The definition in policies is often quite broad, usually covers acts meant to cause widespread fear, disrupt essential services, or coerce governments for political, religious, or ideological reasons.
Hmm.
Now, there's the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, TRA, which can provide some coverage for certified terrorism losses, but standard E&O exclusions might still apply to events that aren't officially certified. War II, declared or undeclared, typically excluded.
That covers some pretty big potential events. What about things that happened in the past or deliberate wrongdoing?
Okay, so prior acts claims from mistakes made before your continuous E&O coverage started, usually excluded unless you specifically bought prior acts coverage.
Right.
And no surprise, intentional acts like fraud, embezzlement, larceny, basically theft, false imprisonment, those are standard exclusions too. These involve deliberate misconduct, which E&O just isn't designed to cover. The document actually defines each of these pretty clearly.
So E&O is really about negligence and mistakes, not deliberate crime.
Yeah.
Okay, let's shift now to being more proactive. What can professionals actually do to minimize the chance of E&O claims happening?
Right. This is where prevention is key. The document has a lot of practical advice here. A core principle is sell what is known and know what is sold. Make sure you really understand the coverages you're talking about.
Makes sense.
Given that the number one cause of E&O claims is failing to get the right coverage, using things like exposure analysis surveys or checklists to figure out your client's actual needs is absolutely critical.
That seems fundamental. Understanding the client's risks protects everyone. What other prevention tips are there?
It's really important to clearly explain to clients what their policy doesn't cover, just as much as what it does. If you don't know the answer to a question, best to just admit it and promise to find the correct info.
Good advice.
If you work with the excess and surplus market, the E&S market, for harder to place risks, know that they often use unique policy forms with different exclusions. You need to get those documents and read them carefully.
Okay.
And avoid making coverage decisions for your clients. Give them options, explain them, and document their choices thoroughly. Stay informed about the financial health of your carriers and stick strictly to their binding authority rules, what you're actually allowed to approve. And, you know, just be honest and upfront with the carriers and all your dealings.
Those are great guiding principles. What about more specific, like, day-to-day practices to cut down on errors and keep clients happy?
Implementing solid quality control checks is huge. Regular checks, even random ones, can really encourage people to be more thorough.
Mm.
Promote a culture where double-checking important tasks is just standard practice. Find and fix weaknesses in your internal systems or training. And crucially, always, always verify that the final policy actually matches what was agreed on during the sale. Names, limits, coverages all have to be right. Setting up internal audits to regularly review procedures can also be really effective.
What should you think about when setting up a quality control program like that?
You need to be clear on who does the reviews, what exactly gets reviewed, and what happens if errors are found. Initially, maybe treat errors as training issues, but if they keep happening, there need to be consequences.
Right.
Decide how detailed the reviews should be, when they happen in the workflow, and where they're most effective. At a minimum, check names, limits, and policy forms when they come in. Maybe have a separate person or department handle reviews. Audit client files periodically, look at the exposure analysis, proposals, applications, correspondence. Having documented steps for fixing problems also protects the business if discipline is needed later.
The document also mentions these L's that can lead to problems and potentially E&O claim. What are those again?
Yes, the L's. Lack of attention, lack of consistency, lack of concern, lack of contact, lack of knowledge, and lack of action.
Okay.
And to make those more real, the document then uses these have you ever scenarios. They really bring potential mistakes to life.
Those scenarios are pretty telling, aren't they? Failing to get coverage requested, withholding info from the carrier, forgetting to add coverage, relying on a verbal nod from an underwriter.
Exactly. And others too, like not returning unearned premium promptly, not calling a client back about increasing coverage, not updating a binder when the carrier pushes back, sloppy notes on phone calls.
Yeah.
Failing to report a claim quickly, that Progressive v. Boyd case is a big warning there, can lead to bad faith claims against the insurer. Not checking a new employee's work. Even something seemingly small, like backdating a receipt that's deceptive and risky.
It's really clear that being meticulous and documenting everything is just non-negotiable.
Okay, moving beyond minimizing claims. What specific practices should professionals actively avoid doing?
Right. The document lists several definite don'ts. Twisting, churning, rebating. These are all unethical, often illegal insurance sales tactics. Avoid them completely.
Okay.
Redlining, discriminating against certain neighborhoods, often based on race, is illegal and strictly warned against. Misrepresentation, false advertising, making untrue claims about policies or your business, big no-no.
Absolutely.
Commingling funds, mixing client money with your own huge breach of trust, can cost you your license. Never tell a client something's covered without written proof. Don't make the coverage call too early on a claim.
Yeah.
And always fully explain actual cash value so clients understand how claims might be paid.
Those are some clear warnings. What about positive practices? Things professionals should be doing. Definitely some key things to institute. Date stamping all incoming mail gives you proof of when you receive something. Always. always have the insured sign the application and sign any requests for changes protect you if they later say, that's not what I agreed to.
Smart.
Check the standard market first before going to assigned risk or residual markets. Understand the differences and any state rules about needing a declination first. When replacing a policy, get a copy of the old one. Check insurability, features, limits, costs, and maybe let the current agent know you're looking.
Good practice.
Send complete applications to the carrier quickly. Keep copies. Never give out blank signed certificates of insurance too easy to misuse. Don't advance your own money for slow-paying clients. The policy isn't enforced without payment anyway.
Right.
Don't just tell a client they have coverage verbally. Get it in writing. Same goes for telling them there isn't coverage, document exclusions or deletions in writing.
That's a really solid list of do's and don'ts. Now let's dig into a specific type of E&O policy, the claims-made policy. How is that different from other insurance?
Okay, yeah. The document points out most professional liability is written this way. A claims-made and reported policy basically covers claims that are first made against you during the current policy year.
Okay.
And importantly, it's for professional services you provided after a specific date called the prior acts date. So the trigger for coverage is when the claim is made and reported to the insurance company while the policy is active.
So it's less about when the mistake happened and more about when the claim pops up and you report it.
Yeah.
What are the key parts of these policies we need to understand?
Several critical pieces. The prior acts date that's listed on the policy declarations, it basically says claims from services before that date aren't covered. Ideally, this date stays the same when you renew or switch claims made policies.
Right.
The current policy year, that's just the effective and expiration dates. The policy limits, that's the max the insurer will pay for one claim, and the total max for all claims in that policy year. And often, those limits include your legal defense costs.
Ah, that's important. Wow. Including defense costs.
Yeah. And you have to watch out. If you have multiple claims in 1 year, you could potentially run out of coverage if your aggregate limit isn't high enough.
That's a good point about the aggregate limit. So
yeah.
If you decide later to increase your policy limits, does that higher limit apply back to services you did in the past?
Generally, yes. That's a key benefit. Increasing your limits on a claims-made policy often boosts protection for services going all the way back to your prior acts date. It's a way to enhance your coverage over time.
Okay.
And often, the extra cost to bump up your limits is pretty reasonable, making it a good value way to get more protection.
The document includes a sample policy declaration page.
Mm.
What are the key sections there that you should really pay attention to when looking at your own policy?
Okay. When you look at your deck page, definitely check. The parent organization listed, the exact policy period dates, the limit of liability, and crucially, whether defense costs are inside or in addition to that limit.
Right.
Check the retention, that's your deductible. The insured percentage, if any, sometimes you might share a tiny bit of the risk, the total premium, obviously. Any details about a discovery period option, we'll talk about that. The specific rules for giving notice of a claim, the pending and prior litigation date, if there is one. And super important, any attached endorsements, because those change the standard policy language.
You mentioned claims made versus occurrence policies earlier. Can you just quickly recap the main difference?
Sure. An occurrence policy covers claims from incidents that happen during the policy period, no matter when the claim is actually reported.
Okay.
This can lead to long tail liabilities, uncertainty.
Okay.
Claims made, like we said, covers claims reported while the policy is active for acts that might have happened earlier, as long as you have that prior acts coverage.
Got it. What exactly is prior acts coverage then? And how does it relate to the retroactive date on a claims made policy?
Okay. Prior acts coverage gives you protection for mistakes or omissions that happened before your current claims made policy started. The prior acts period is that specific time frame before the current policy where claims are covered.
Mm-hmm.
You usually get this if you had a claims made policy immediately before the current one, so there's no gap. The retroactive date, sometimes called the continuity date, is the earliest date an act or error can have occurred and still be covered if a claim comes in later. Most claims made policies have one, and it's usually the date you first got continuous E&O coverage on a claims made basis.
Okay.
You might also see a pending and prior litigation exclusion. That just means no coverage for claims related to lawsuits that were already going on or had happened before a certain date.
Now, what if your business is a corporation or an agency? Is the whole company automatically covered if it gets named in a claim along with an individual?
Not necessarily automatically. A lot of E&O policies use what's called a miscellaneous professional liability, or MPL, form. These often need significant customizing to really match your specific services and business practices. Mm. Standard MPL forms often have exclusions, maybe for medical management or accounting functions, that could leave big parts of your business exposed. You really have to analyze your specific operations and make sure the policy covers all your potential risks.
What happens if you stop the policy? Like you terminate the contract, or maybe the insurance company decides not to renew you. What happens to your coverage then?
Right. If your claims made policy ends or isn't renewed, you generally lose coverage for any claims made after that termination date, even if the mistake happened while the policy was active.
Oh, wow.
That's where tail coverage comes in. It's also called an extended reporting period, or ERP. It's optional coverage you can buy that protects you for claims filed after the policy ends, as long as the incident happened while it was in force.
When would you need that?
It's really relevant if you sell your business, close up shop, or just decide you don't need ongoing E&O anymore. The terms and the cost for tail coverage can vary a lot between insurers.
Okay, and what about the other side? When your clients don't renew their policies, what are the risks for you, the agent or broker?
Yes. The document calls this the perils of non-renewals of clients. This is huge. As the agent, it's absolutely critical you make sure timely replacement coverage is arranged for clients whose policies are ending. You cannot let them have a gap.
Right.
That case example in the document, the one with the liquor liability policy that wasn't renewed, the client ended up with a massive uninsured loss. It really shows how serious this can be.
So what exactly should an agent do when they get a non-renewal notice for a client?
Okay, first step. Carefully review the carrier's reasons for non-renewing. Right. Then make a conscious decision. Do you want to keep this client and find them new coverage? If you decide not to find replacement coverage, you must tell the client immediately, both by phone and follow up with a certified letter well before the policy expires. Clearly state it's not being renewed and you won't be seeking replacement coverage.
That's clear.
If you do want to keep the client, you need to start working on replacement coverage right away. Use a diary system, track everything, document all your efforts, quotes you sought, communications, everything. Keep records.
Makes sense.
If finding replacement coverage is tough, talk to the client about asking the expiring carrier for a temporary extension. The main goal, always, is to prevent any lapse in coverage for that client, period.
Really important advice there. What about sub-agents? If someone is working under a prime agent, can the main agent be held responsible if the sub-agent messes up?
Yes, absolutely. The document is clear on this. A prime agent can definitely be held legally liable for the professional errors and omissions of their sub-agents. It gives examples from different fields, law enforcement, healthcare, public admin, showing how mistakes by individuals under an agency's authority can lead back to liability for the principal agent or the whole agency.
We talked about common exclusions earlier. Now that we understand claims-made policies better, are there any exclusions particularly worth highlighting again in this context?
Yeah, revisiting those exclusions is good. Remember, intentional wrongful acts are always out. E&O covers honest mistakes, not deliberate fraud or crime.
Right.
Bodily injury and property damage claims those belong under other policies like workers' comp, auto liability, property insurance generally excluded from E&O. Liability you assume under a contract often needs specific policy changes to be covered.
Okay.
And claims for professional services you perform in certain specific roles like actuary, accountant, attorney, real estate agent might be excluded depending on your specific policy wording and endorsements.
The document then gets into tort principles liability of professionals. What are the key takeaways there?
The main idea is that a professional isn't automatically liable just because things didn't turn out well for the client. Usually, three things have to be proven for negligence. One, you failed to perform with reasonable care and competence expected in your field.
Okay.
Two, you made an error or omission that a reasonably competent professional wouldn't have made in similar circumstances. And three, that failure or error directly caused harm or damage to someone else.
Got it.
It's also important to know the difference between contract claims saying you didn't do what you agreed to do and tort claims saying your performance was below professional standards. They might have different statutes of limitations, too.
And what about liability that comes directly from laws and regulations?
Right. There are laws with broad reach, like RICO, that can hit professionals for things like mail or wire fraud related to their services. Plus, there are laws specific to certain professions, like federal and state securities laws and SEC regulations. These set standards for stockbrokers, financial planners, accountants, lawyers involved in finance. Even something like a lawyer missing a simple filing deadline in a contract case, causing financial loss that probably wouldn't be covered by standard general liability, it'd fall under professional liability.
The document also specifically calls out accountant professional liability exposures. Mm-hmm. What are the main risks for accountants?
Accountants face potential liability from three main angles. Tort law, not performing with proper skill.
Right.
Contract law, not fulfilling the agreement, maybe affecting third parties too. And statutory law, like securities laws, Sarbanes-Oxley.
Okay.
Specific risks include mistakes in tax services, late filings, wrong advice leading to penalties or disallowed deductions, errors in audits where others rely on the financials, problems in compilation and review work like not following GAAP. And securities laws can lead to huge defense costs and settlements for alleged false statements in financial documents.
We talked about commingling funds for insurance agents. How does that apply elsewhere?
Commingling, mixing client money with your own is a big problem for many professionals, yeah? Real estate brokers handling deposits, for instance, that money must stay separate in trust accounts. Also, just refusing to collect or pay client funds promptly can create liability.
The document mentions insolvency, bankruptcy, and exceptions. How does that tie into E&O?
Okay, insolvency just means you can't pay your debts. Bankruptcy is the formal legal process. The doc notes different types. Chapter 7, liquidation. Chapter 11, reorganization, often businesses. Chapter 13, repayment plans, individuals.
Right.
Filing bankruptcy usually triggers an automatic stay, which can pause legal actions like an E&O claim. But importantly, some debts, especially those from fraud, usually can't be discharged in bankruptcy.
What about damages that are caused intentionally? Are those ever covered?
Nope. Financial damages cause deliberately things that lead to punitive or exemplary damages because of intentional misconduct, generally not covered by E&O. The examples given, like malicious defamation or a broker churning an account just for commissions, show the kind of deliberate actions that are outside E&O protection.
Other specific liability areas mentioned were commission disputes, tax advice, and promising future investment values.
That's right. Commission disagreements, get it clear in a written agreement. Tax advice errors by professionals like accountants can lead to liability for penalties, disallowed deductions, and never guarantee future investment values or pension fund performance. Promises of specific returns that don't happen are typically excluded from E&O. You absolutely have to explain investment risks clearly and get signed acknowledgments. The case example in the doc highlights this.
We touched on punitive damages being excluded. Can you just quickly define those again?
Sure. Punitive damages, or exemplary damages, are extra money awarded in lawsuits to punish a defendant for really bad behavior, malicious, fraudulent, reckless acts. It's meant to make an example, on top of compensating the victim. Coverage for these under E&O is often optional and might not even be allowed in some places.
Got it. And finally, under exclusions, the document briefly lists nuclear incidents, pollutants, sexual molestation, and discrimination.
Yeah, these are pretty standard across liability policies. Nuclear and pollutant risks usually need specialized environmental policies. Sexual molestation, often defined broadly to include harassment, generally excluded. And discrimination in insurance setting rates or benefits based on protected characteristics without a valid business reason that's illegal and excluded.
Okay.
There's also usually an exclusion for multiplication of damages, things like fines, liquidated damages, punitive damages again, or compensatory damages multiplied by law. And the document clarifies exclusions for third-party claims and activities around solicitation or placement of insurance in certain situations.
Okay, that's a very deep dive into what E&O usually excludes. Now, let's shift to the claims process itself. If someone thinks they might have an E&O claim situation brewing, what's the right way to report it?
Prompt and proper reporting is absolutely key. The insured agent, you, have a clear duty to give written notice to the insurance company as soon as you possibly can. Definitely no later than 60 days after the policy period ends.
Okay.
Every demand, notice, summons, any legal paper you get forwarded immediately to the insurer's claims department. You also have to cooperate fully with the insurer. And crucially, don't do certain things without the written okay first.
Like what?
Don't agree to arbitration. Don't make payments to the claimant. Don't admit fault or liability. Don't settle the claim yourself. Don't assume any obligations or spend money related to the claim. Get the insurer's okay first.
And what are some of the main ways insurance agents and brokers specifically get into E&O trouble?
As the document stresses, the biggest exposures for agents and brokers are failing to get the right coverage for their clients, or failing to get the specific coverage the client asked for.
Right.
These can come from different legal angles. Tort, meaning negligence in getting the insurance, contract breaking a promise to get certain coverage, or even statute. Some states might legally require you to either get the coverage requested or clearly tell the client you can't.
So if you actually get sued for E&O, what is the absolute first thing you should do?
Report it. Immediately. Report the lawsuit to your E&O carrier right away. And just as critical, do not admit anything. Don't admit you made a mistake. Don't acknowledge any liability. Doing that can seriously mess up your insurance coverage.
When exactly should you report a potential claim? Is it only when you get sued or sooner?
Sooner. The duty to report kicks in as soon as you become aware of any incident that has resulted in or could reasonably be expected to result in a claim against you. It's much broader than just waiting for a lawsuit.
Okay.
The document defines a claim broadly: any written or verbal demand for money or services, or any allegation you messed up in providing professional services. Best practice: err on the side of caution. Report potential claim situations early.
What usually happens after you report a potential claim? What can you expect?
Okay. Once you report it, the insurer will typically assign a claims examiner. They'll contact you to get all the details, figure out what happened, and start planning how to handle it.
Right.
Sometimes they might suggest ways to try and resolve it before it becomes a formal claim. If they need more info, you might meet with the examiner or an adjuster. If it looks like legal defense is needed, you'll likely be involved in choosing the defense lawyer. And remember, only give information and statements about it directly to your E&O carrier and their reps.
The document also talks about the impact an E&O claim can have, not just financially, but on the producer and the agency. What kind of effects are we talking about?
It can be significant. For the individual producer, it means lost time digging up documents, participating in the process,
right,
time not spent selling, so potential lost commissions, plus just the stress, anxiety, maybe a hit to your confidence.
Yeah, I can imagine.
For the agency, it's staff time finding records, people involved in interviews, potential legal stuff. It can create stress, even kind of paralyze the office workflow. And then there's the potential reputation damage if word gets out. Strained relationships with clients, carriers, other brokers. It ripples outward.
The advice to gather all relevant material in a hard copy file seems so simple, but potentially so important.
It really is. A well-organized hard copy file with everything related to a client in their coverage can be your absolute best defense if a claim comes up.
Right.
The document says the two most common claim types are failure to provide the proper coverage and failure to place coverage after agreeing to. Now, many E&O claims don't actually have legal merit, but you still get a defense under your policy. Having thorough documentation notes on conversations, recommendations, explanations is critical to defending yourself successfully. And like we said, forward all documents about any potential or actual claim straight to your E&O carrier.
The document includes that section. Could it have been an innocent or avoidable error or omission? With those case examples.
Yeah.
What are some key lessons from those real situations?
Those examples really show how small, unintentional mistakes can lead to big trouble. Like failing to send a premium payment on time can cause a coverage gap, like in that health insurance case with the big settlement.
Wow.
Keeping contact info updated is crucial. That Keyman life policy canceled because of a wrong address. Huge settlement. Other examples show risks from improper advertising, sloppy handling of broker of record letters, not acting quickly on requests like deleting coverage,
mm-hmm,
the dangers of advancing premiums, letting unlicensed staff give advice, charging sketchy service fees, and notary errors. That's an interesting one. The document points out notary E&O is cheap and really valuable for anyone doing notary work because mistakes there can have big consequences too.
The document also quickly outlines how a lawsuit starts and the typical stages.
Yeah, it usually kicks off when you're formally served with a summons and complaint, maybe in person, sometimes by mail. You then have a deadline to file a formal response, your appearance, and answer.
Okay.
Then comes discovery. Both sides gather info using depositions, interrogatories, requests for documents. Many cases settle during this, but if not, it might go to trial before a judge or jury. If you lose, the court issues an order on damages or remedies, and the loser might be able to appeal, but grounds are limited and appeals are expensive.
The document wraps up with a bunch of case studies across different insurance lines and broker issues. Are there any big themes or lessons from all those examples?
They really just hammer home how varied E&O claims can be. Everything from overcharging clients, not getting enough fire or auto coverage, disputes over premiums or verbal agreements, fights over claim payments using unlicensed insurers. The lessons are consistent. Clear communication, thorough documentation, understanding policy terms, following up on binders, keeping up with client needs. The broker malpractice cases show risks from bad underwriting, unsuitable investments, churning accounts, unauthorized trades, misleading statements, fiduciary duty breaches.
Lots of potential pitfalls.
And the broker E&O cases highlight needing sufficient policy limits to protect the agency itself. The additional insured cases show complexities in health insurance denials and how policies define a single occurrence.
That's a massive amount of information and definitely a reminder of all the potential risks out there for professionals. To sort of bring this deep dive to a close, what are the absolute most critical takeaways about E&O insurance you'd want our listeners to really remember?
I think the number one thing is that in today's business world, E&O insurance really isn't optional anymore for a huge range of professionals. It's pretty much a necessity.
Right.
And crucially, remember, not all E&O policies are created equal. You have to read yours, understand the details, what triggers coverage, what activities are covered, who exactly is insured. Especially if you're thinking of switching carriers, get a specimen policy and review it before you commit.
Good advice.
And finally, don't just guess or use simple rules of thumb for your policy limits. Really think about the kinds of claims you are most likely to face in your profession. Remembering that failure to provide the proper coverage is consistently a top cause of claims.
So the rising expectations on professionals just make having solid, well-understood E&O coverage even more vital.
Exactly. The public, the legal system, they expect a high standard. E&O isn't just a safety net for losses. It's a fundamental tool for navigating the risks built into your work.
Yeah.
You need to consider the full scope of your potential liabilities and make sure your coverage is solid and that you really get what it protects even against those honest, unintentional mistakes.
Some really valuable insights to mull over. Thank you so much for walking us through all of this on errors and omissions insurance. It definitely gave us a lot to think about.
My pleasure. Yeah, just remember, really understanding your risks and your insurance coverage is always the best first step to protecting your professional future.